Hey, everybody, welcome to another Bald Move Television, the officially unofficial podcast for all of television. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And we are rolling on with our all TV mandate to talk about Amazon. We're not limited to just terrestrial broadcasts or cable boxes. We're on the internet, we're on the World Wide Web. Because Amazon's got a new series helmed by Matthew Weiner. But Matthew the Wiener Weiner, which we're big fans of his Mad Men. Mm-hmm. We did the Mad Men Happy Hour for many years, had a lot of fun, a lot of laughs, a lot of tears on that podcast. It's been gone for 3 years. This is his first return to television, essentially. And he's got the Romanovs, which is an anthology that purports to be about a different member of the lost Romanov family, the last czarist regime in Russia before the Bolsheviks took over. I wouldn't say that like they're all necessarily actual Romanovs, but they have the sincere belief that they are Romanovs. Mm-hmm. We saw the first two episodes that were released this over the weekend. I think it's actually on Friday, and they're going to release one episode a week each week after this on Amazon. Jim, what did you make of Matthew Weiner's new series?
So here's why people get paid the big bucks, because I have zero interest in the topic of the show. And as a matter of fact, when you tell me, okay, we're going to make a series of movies because these are all hour and a half episodes, and they're all going to be about a different set of people who think they're Romanovs, I couldn't be less interested, honestly. So the only reason I checked this out is because Matthew Weiner is attached to it. And you know, he's the creator, he's the director, he's the writer. So it's got Weiner all over it.
it's smattered with Weiner. Yeah,
it sure is. And so, like, you know, that's why you pay Matthew Weiner, because people come in just for the name.
Right.
That said, I think it was okay. I suppose I didn't not enjoy myself watching it, but I found it to be a little bit odd. Maybe the way that all these things are tied together is dubious at best, and is definitely like, I like actually how James Poniewozik put it. He's, you know, longtime reviewer of the Weiner. In the New York Times article that he wrote, he said that this is essentially Black Mirror for a dying aristocracy. Which makes a lot of sense now that I've seen the first two episodes.
I think that I was a good halfway through the first episode not knowing what to make of it. But then they got to the scene where, and I guess we'll do I won't do spoilers, actually. We got to a scene where there's a seduction, and I started getting really engrossed into it, and I'm like, you know what I miss from Mad Men, and I guess The Leftovers, is these very emotionally complex situations that have genuine tension that aren't like tied into this bomb has to be defused, or this wall has to be defended, or ice zombies will take over the world, or, you know, there it's just two people, and, you know, compromising situations and asking you what you think about this morally and ethically, and whether it feels real. And I started to get really into it from there, because the other thing I thought was that these episodes are attempts to deconstruct classic Hollywood tropes. Like, the first episode is essentially 16 Candles, you know, a privileged guy who's kind of like, you know, disaffected, decides to treat a person from a lower caste or a different class, like a Cinderella, as kind of like a gag or a scam or of some sort, and then catches feelings, and what do they do? And like, and then the woman finds out, it's everything is much more like, I guess, heightened realism. And it's like the difference between if you've seen, like, you know, a Ren and Stimpy cartoon, and then you see someone try to make like a photorealistic Ren and Stimpy and how bizarre it looks. Like, I feel like the Violet Hour is a photorealistic you know, John Hughes film. And The Royal We was kind of like a photorealistic, you know, romantic comedy, you know, where
Titanic.
there's big twists, there's big turns, there's things that like are shocking, but you kind of see coming, and then they subvert that shock. So I guess at that, I thought it was kind of interesting to see, you know, what felt like pretty tropey situations be kind of turned on their heads. And then also, I felt like a lot of the writing and the performances were very smart and interesting and held my interest. Interesting that held my interest. but I also wonder if there's not going to be something that the sum is more, or the whole is more than just a part.
Maybe.
You know? We're two episodes in, if there's going to be an actual thesis that emerges from all this. I heard that, like, the John Slattery's character, who makes a brief cameo in episode two, is not the actual episode that he was, like, billed as being a part of. So maybe there's, like, a little bit of a thread that is going to be running through all of these that we can tease out. But no, I, like I said, I spent the first 30, 40 minutes, not just like confused and wondering if this is good and this, if I like this, but also with the extra, like, gee whiz, what am I going to say if I don't like the new, you know, Matthew Weiner?
You could say you don't like the new Matthew Weiner show.
I know, but I mean, it's just like, it's a bummer. It's a bummer for me. It's a bummer. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's a little bit of that, like, I don't know. I got this weird, like, podcaster thing where that awareness of like, oh no, what if I don't like something and how am I going to talk about it in a way that won't piss people off, like, started to creep in. But like I said, after the second half of episode one, and I pretty much totally enjoyed episode two.
I will say, I liked episode two better than episode one. Maybe it was just because I was finding my footing.
But yeah, like I said, I feel like they're definitely worth watching. Are they? And then the other thing is, are they, man, it's like, is it as good as Mad Men? Because, like, imagine Mad Men in a 90-minute format. That's it. It's just, you've got to introduce Don and Peggy and you know, the antagonists like Peter or Pete Campbell, and you got to do it in like the first 30 to 40 minutes so the rest of the thing can play. And like, how kind of just, you know, stripped down and pared down that experience would be. And I just, it's really unfortunate that his last thing was Mad Men. That is very long, sprawling, intensely interesting, very watchable serial that came out over seven, you know, like, you know, hundreds of hours of television. Now you're looking at like, okay, here is about 10 hours of something. But I don't know. Is it because no one gives a shit about the Romanovs, or is it because who gave a shit about 60s era's Mad Men, you know, or admin?
Yeah. I don't know. Certainly I think the subject matter is less interesting to me. And I don't even know that I would compare these two things, because like you're describing, it's so apples to oranges here. We've got, you know, the 90-minute format, one and done kind of stories, and then you've got that seven season huge arc of an intimate look at these characters. I think it's very, very different. So I don't even know if I would approach the idea of which is better.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think you're, that's what I was kind of groping for, is it's a fool's errand, but yet everyone's doing it, you know? And I think, cause I was trying to, I resisted watching any reviews or listening to any reviews. I didn't even go on a forum thread for the Romanovs. Cause I know that got, you know, created as soon as the series was announced, and I didn't want to get contaminated, but I felt as I was reading like my old familiars, like, you know, I read Podniewozniak and, I read, the Sepinwall and a couple others. And I'm like, they did seem like, I mean, I don't think they were uninterested, or at least, you know, but there was like, you know, this kind of like reserved quality to the review. Like, this, you know, is good, but not great. Maybe a little disappointing. A lot of takes on like what this means in the context of like the, you know, Me Too movement and like Matthew Weiner's, you know, accusation of sexual harassment that came out late last year. That I guess I'm glad I missed all that because I probably like seeing this as like kind of a mild disappointment, I think might have influenced me to be like, oh yeah, like I'd have been looking for the flaws rather than trying to just engage with the material. Did you like, I don't know. Did you, were you checking this series out before you actually watched it or?
No, okay. Not at all. I went and I read, like I said, James Poniewozik's review in the Times after mm-hmm. I'd seen both episodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And largely I came away feeling the same way that he did. After reading his review, I was like, oh yeah, no, I did not have a weird perspective on this. This is just actually mm-hmm. how most people felt, that it was, you know, interesting but odd, and maybe didn't quite hit exactly how they wanted it to, and myself also.
Yeah, it's funny because when I first heard this project, I'm like, Romanovs, huh, a historical period piece about the downfall. Like, I assumed the downfall of the House Romanov. And then when I heard, oh, no, no, it's set in modern day and it's going to be like putative descendants of Romanovs, I'm like, well, that's as weird as fuck.
Uh-huh.
And like when I was watching the credit sequence, which is, you know, the Romanovs getting blown away and their blood running across this floor, interspaced with like all these photographs of their family, and then like it turns from like classical music to Tom Petty's Refugee, and there's this really cool shot of like what I think you're supposed to understand is Anastasia Romanoff, the one that, you know, is always purported to have gotten away, fleeing in her, you know, little blue riding hood. And it morphing into a girl in like a blue wind jacket that's just like walking up the staircase, like that you get this idea that like there's this historic loss that has pulled something out of all these people. And regardless of what had actually happened, the idea of it happening is the important part. And I thought it was interesting juxtaposition. We're going to probably get into heavy spoilers from here on out. So if you haven't had a chance to watch it, I can't imagine this review would move you either way. But, you know, I just want to give you fair warning.
Can I say, like, watch episode 2 first?
I guess it doesn't matter.
It's the more interesting of the two episodes. At least it was to me. Maybe the easier to engage with of the two.
I won't argue that because like the first half of the first episode I thought was such a hoary trope of this, like, you know, driving Miss Daisy bullshit mm-hmm. that like I got more interested in the second half. I do think the first episode's maybe more visually beautiful, but that's probably just because, my god, that apartment in Paris, France.
I know, you can't beat it.
You go to certain parts of Paris with the right camera and the right lighting and it's like, my god, is there a more beautiful city in the world?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would say that like episode 2 is broadly speaking the more entertaining and interesting of the episodes. But I think it's also interesting because like episode 1 also leans into kind of what I thought the Romanovs would be, like this aging aristocracy that's desperately trying to hold on to that prestige and power in a way that the rest of the world thinks is silly and anachronistic. Yeah. And the second episode was more of like, I don't know, like, you know, a middle class American Romanov that's just like feels like he should be an emperor and he's not.
Yeah, until you get to the boat and then there are some silly anachronisms there, you know, some over the top ridiculous.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But yeah, we should talk spoilers because I do want to talk about some details.
Hey, before we get in depth with the Romanovs, I want to talk about upcoming things here at baldmove.com. Next week, we're pretty excited. We got a new feature, completely new type of feature, called the Super Serious Film Fest. And we see it as like a spiritual successor to the Commission podcast, which we're bringing to a close this year. It's a chance for us to talk about a lot of our favorite movies, a lot of your favorite movies, in a more structured, interesting kind of format. The first Super Serious Film Fest is subtitled Season of the Cage. And it's about... we're taking a sampling of 6 different Nick Cage movies, 3 of his best movies and 3 of his worst movies. And there's going to be a lot of special features on YouTube that we release. Some of this is going to be club content. Some of it's going to be free publicly available content. We're actually bringing on Guy Ferrari to punch up some of the problems we see in the scripts of some of these films, to do his take, his vision of what a movie, if he had free creative reign, to do whatever he wanted to it, Again, we're pretty excited about it. Super Serious Film Fest. Look for more information next week. Also, the Final Empire Business dropped this week, where we do the studio tour, the studio as it was before we decommissioned it, because we're actually going to be moving studios either late this year or early next year, because if you didn't know, we're actually broadcasting out of Jim's basement right now. We got Bald Cave 2.0. That's out. We're still covering The Deuce every Tuesday. Better Call Saul will have our final podcast this Wednesday before the off season, where we wrap things up for season 4. Cecily and I are still doing American Horror Story and having a ton of fun doing it. Jim and I took a chance on Bad Times at El Royale. Had some bad times, had some good times. And finally, we got to see Oliver Stone's JFK as one of our final commissioned podcasts. Check all that stuff out at baldmove.com. Okay, so let's talk about episode 1 first, The Violet Hour. Let's start with the title, because what is a violet hour?
So in this episode, the violet hour is referenced in a couple of scenes. One is a description of the sky when this old aristocratic woman son drowns in a lake.
Mm-hmm.
Or drowned somewhere. I don't know if it's a lake, but she said that, you know, the sky was more of a violet color than the described light blue. And then at the very end of the episode, after, you know, Aaron Eckhart gets, I guess, the child that he's always been wanting, but never told his girlfriend he wanted.
Right. The heir.
The heir, the lineage. The sky turns violet there again. So it seems like there's some connection, I think, between the Violet Hour and the lineage sort of perpetuating, or maybe a dying of the old aristocracy and a new birth of a different type of blend. Because, you know, this old woman is very concerned about the lineage. That's like the one thing she wants before she dies, is to know that the Romanov line will be preserved.
Right.
Which I don't know why, you know, 1,500 of her other cousins couldn't do it or something, but whatever. She wants the lineage preserved through her. And so she doesn't want it to change. And then, you know, when it's announced that this Muslim woman is pregnant with Aaron Eckhart's baby, then they do that Violet Hour thing. And it's almost like they're saying, hey, this is the blending of the old aristocracy with the modern world and how the modern world is changing.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, as someone whose parenting schedule has caused me to see more sunrises than I've seen in my entire life combined in the last month. Like, there is that, both sunset and sunrise could be described as the violet hour. When her son is, I like that. It's like when her son is drowning, that's her seeing like the sunset setting on her part of the Romanov Empire. And I think you said something like, oh, her other 1,500 cousins could do, you know, but it does seem like, and I want to talk about this as a larger topic next, maybe, but like in this particular show, the Romanovs as a diaspora seem throughout both episodes preoccupied with keeping the lineage. Like when, you know, what was the Corey Stoll's wife's name? Emily?
I just know her as Carrie Boucher.
Who's great. She, you know, they talk about not having kids, and, you know, the other Romanovs like, oh my God, the society will die out within a generation if it's like that. Like, it does seem like it's something that they're preoccupied by. So I like the idea that, like, this is the sun setting and then unexpected rise of the sun in this lady. Which, I mean, the thing that didn't work, I guess, for me in this episode was the final scene of, like, you know, Eric and Hajar inhabiting this apartment, and like he's literally dressed up like a czar, and the old lady with the candle, like she's almost a creepy ghost lady. I wasn't sure what they were trying to go with on that.
I think you said what they were going for. They wanted this to look like an old photo of the Romanov family, like you'd see in the early 1900s or late 1800s, you know?
But why? I mean, I was like, it's like, yeah, I was like, I don't know. It's funny because, like, I feel like what is less is a lot less interesting. Like, being able to say, like, what a scene is depicting is less interesting than, like, why, what is the purpose of that scene showing? And there's a lot of people. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I feel like they're showing how different this Romanov family has become. You know, like there's a scene in the market where the old lady is having Hajar do all of her shopping for her.
Uh-huh.
And then these two very old, very crusty white people come up and they're mm-hmm. like, oh, can you believe, like, you know, we got brown skinned people in our markets.
Right, right.
Well, what a fucking
France
travesty.
Changing, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's in there to kind of contrast with the very end where she's just happy that the lineage is going on. He's happy because he got a child, which was something he wanted. And it doesn't have to look like those old photos in, you know, skin tone or religion necessarily. It just looks like those old photos in spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
You know, it's like the blending of the cultures, the blending of the
right.
peoples. Like the family is changing, and you can still call it the Romanov family, and
right.
you do when you look at that picture. You go, oh my god, that's an aristocracy right there.
Yeah.
But the people involved in it are very different than they were.
Yeah, they're definitely playing in that first episode a lot of, like, you know, you can't be French. The old lady who's just the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And she's talking, you know, she gets this Muslim caretaker. And they have, like, just this, like, you know, verbal war in the first couple of encounters with each other. And the old lady's thesis is, well, you're an immigrant. And she's like, no, I'm not. I was born here. She goes, well, you'll never be French.
Right.
And then you fast forward a little bit and she's letting her, you know, Hajar dress up in these, you know, old costumes from the aristocracy. And when she puts on this blue outfit, which I think, again, is supposed to emphasize the Anastasia,
mm-hmm.
she's absurdly beautiful. She looks like a Disney princess.
Yeah.
Like
with the tiara and everything.
Yeah, like my nieces would see that and want to buy her at, you know, Toys R Us if there was still Toys R Us's.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's part of, like, this panic of, like, France transforming into something that's unrecognizable is silly on multiple fronts. Number one, France has transformed, like, 200 Frenchmen from 200 years ago would not recognize the capital now.
Yeah.
Or even back in the 70s or 60s when France was still, like, you know, whatever the idea of these people of France is. And then second, like, the idea that some of these people might transform, it's not just that France itself is transforming, but the people are being transformed by France. That, like, a person like Hajar could be a Romanov princess if she marries a Zarek guy. Like, mm-hmm. in the world wouldn't just fucking fall off its goddamn axis. I think that's another interesting thing that they're playing with.
Didn't, like, some British royalty just marry, like, a movie star or something?
Well, an American TV star, yeah.
American TV star, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
A half-black one at that. There was the many, many Jimmys rustled. Many Jimmys rustled.
Yeah, so I wonder if it's, you know, pulled right out of current events kind of thing.
It might be. It's weird because, like, I felt like there's the other thing. There was a little bit of both sides-ism on the, like, that Matthew Weiner was engaging, where, you know, Hajar's mom showed up and she was pretty awful in how she depicted Hajar's sex life and Eric's motivations, although I think that she's pretty much right about Aaron Eckert, at least his beginning motivations.
Yeah.
Because that's, do you want to talk, that's the other thing I want to talk about. Like, there is an interesting thing that happens where I think Aaron Eckert explicitly set out to seduce this woman and try to, as a way to win this apartment, which is his kind of life's chief aspiration, to get this big fancy apartment that is his aunt's been in haunting for the last few decades.
Yeah.
And I felt like he started off as, like, you know, he came out of that bathroom after he did the, like, full emotional court press of this isn't right and this is blah and this is, and it wasn't getting anywhere. And he, like, went to the bathroom, smoothed his hair back. He's like, okay, I'm gonna try a charm offensive.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like he, like, as the night wore on, he just couldn't do it. Like, she was just too earnest and forthright and honest. And I actually think that the night was probably going to end until she tripped and skinned her knee, which then led him back, you know, led to them going back to the hotel. And then I think that he became aware that she was actually very interested in him as a person. And he goes and he's thinking about like his current lover and how she's kind of awful in her way.
Oh yeah.
Although, and I can't finish a thought before I go digress into something. But yeah, like what's your opinion on like when did this become something that was exploitative and when did it become something that we're supposed to feel good about? Because I felt like I felt good about the final scene where, you know, Eric embraced Hajar and his old girlfriend stole the Fabergé egg and ran off into the night.
the fake Fabergé egg, maybe?
Yeah, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that they actually earned it. I felt like there was a step that was skipped because Aaron Eckhart is dashingly handsome and Hajar.
Well, you always skip a few steps when you're dashingly handsome.
Sure, and Hajar is just radiantly beautiful, uh-huh. And they both are kind of like, you know, kindred spirits in that, you know, they believe in things that they can't prove and they're groping for that. But like, did it work for you?
I'll say I never came around on it. I actually think that last scene is a little weird and gross to me.
Kind of ghoulish if in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he's using her as a means to an end. And the only thing that changes in that final scene is the end. Like instead of getting an apartment, he gets a child. And I think he mm-hmm. wanted both of those things, but
yeah,
but both of them felt kind of gross at the end to me.
Well, the other thing, I guess, is like I from his perspective, I buy the turnaround because, you know, his other girlfriend. I mean, but that's the other thing is like part of trying to untangle, like, do I believe this Eric character would toss what's her face over for Hajar? Yeah, I could totally see that happening. But then I also think, was his girlfriend really that awful? Because I was thinking of, like, if I had an aunt who I loved and she's in France and I've moved over there to take care of her for 5+ years and I'm living, like, you know, this kind of, you know, comfortable but unfulfilling experience and I'm at her beck and call and every time I try to do something nice, she fakes these illnesses to keep me on. Like, I can see hating her and I can see my girlfriend, like, just thinking that she's the worst person ever. And does that, I don't know, does that, I kept on thinking, like, well, like, do I feel a lot better if, like, Eric's girlfriend is just a totally irredeemable evil person? But mm-hmm. and the show's wanting me to think that, like, she's a vulture, but the only the reason I think that is because she hates the aunt who is a terrible character, and the aunt who is the terrible character calls her a vulture.
That, and I think at the end she kind of proves where her interests lied the entire time. It's with the money, it's with the apartment, it's with, you know, the Fabergé egg that she steals. She's very quick to, like, relinquish that relationship and just take the egg and leave.
But on the other hand, from her perspective, this is like some unbelievable shit that's happening.
Absolutely.
You just found out that your boyfriend, who, you know, all accounts looks like you've had a happy relationship with, even though it's been, like, you know, problematic from the aunt standpoint, you found out that he had an affair with this girl he was supposed to swindle the apartment out of, and she's pregnant, and her very Muslim mother is now haranguing you about morals and this stuff, and now he's got this idiot grin on his face and is throwing you over.
No, it's totally understandable.
I think I might steal a Fabergé egg if I didn't give a shit about the Fabergé egg, you know?
But she does, and there's this big smile on her face at the end, and I think that's the thing, well, one of the things that ties the two episodes together. Mm-hmm. You look at the people who are not Romanovs in this situation getting the fuck out of the Romanov family and being happy about it, right?
Yeah.
Because these people are genuinely fucked up in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe she's not the worst person in the world for wanting to get out of that situation. I don't know. There's something else, too, where... the whole time she's talking about killing his aunt, which is, you know, not a great thing to be talking about. And also, there's a line in there. I forget who says it, but something... I think it's when... Eckhart and Hajar. I don't know Eckhart's name in this.
I think it's Eric.
Eric? Mm-hmm. Okay. Eric and Hajar are walking down the streets of Paris, and he's kind of seeing it for the first time again and appreciating just the beauty of Paris, the beauty of the place they're in, and how envious most people are that they can even be there at all. Mm-hmm. And that's a thing that I think that his girlfriend is taking for granted. throughout the episode. And that makes me think that maybe she's, you know, a little bit shitty. Like, she owns a freaking hotel in Paris, and she's got to live there for 5 years. And I feel like she's become somehow jaded with that idea.
Yeah, it seems to be very entitled. Like, I am a very pretty, I'm a very pretty woman, and there's a lot of things that should come easy to me, and yeah. Although,
and
like I said,
it's
hard for me
quite
to
ever good enough either.
Any attitude that she has that arises over the shitty aunt, because she's just the worst. Like, she's the type of person, I saw her eat several meals and never prayed. As soon as her nephew comes over, she affects Roman Catholicism to kind of like fucking embarrass him. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, her obvious racism. I don't. That's the other thing that doesn't quite hold together to me. It's like at the midpoint, they try to start humanizing the old lady by saying, oh, well, you know, she is. I mean, you're supposed to think. Because her name's Anushka or Anastasia, you're supposed to think that, like, if she's not the princess herself, she's like a direct descendant, and she's got all this like psychic horror from her upbringing, and she was forced to quarter Nazis, and one of them raped her sister, and they stole the Fabergé eggs. So she's not really mean. She's just bitter about how her life has turned out.
Right.
But on the other hand, a lot of people have gone through that and as worse and from a far less privileged position than her. And still, the things she said to this Hajar woman are beyond the fucking pale, to the extent to where, like, if I'm Hajar, like, I felt that was interesting too, that, like, she could just go to the home care office and say, this woman's an unabashed racist. I refuse to go back there. And, like, no one would blame her. Like, there's something to be said, I guess, for standing your ground and whatnot. But, like, my God, she's the worst. She's the worst.
Yeah.
Talking about they have no civilization and they're savage and it's all this other, I don't know.
Yeah. Hajar is the longest suffering person I've ever seen.
Right. No, I thought that was interesting, but kind of messy because, it's hard because, like, I think this is something like BoJack Horseman does really well, which is show terrible people and, like, let you understand why they're terrible, but never, like, excuse or want you to, like, you know, defend their behavior. And I felt like Matthew Weiner doesn't quite have that deft touch, or maybe it's just an animation thing where, like, you know, this is an actual human talking about pain and you want to be empathetic to her. But like I said, it's like I felt like they wanted me to feel bad and they wanted me to turn around on this old woman, whereas, like, nah, she's still pretty terrible.
Like, yeah, I definitely had a hard time.
Like, the world's best, brightest, nicest, most long-suffering Muslim woman in France happened to be her caregiver, and she thinks that's a good Muslim. But she probably still thinks Muslims are, you know,
right.
Savages.
Like, right.
I don't know.
There's one other thing I want to talk about.
Yeah.
That kind of bridges these two episodes. You know, obviously the Romanovs are some connective tissue. There's some connective tissue with the non-Romanovs getting the hell out of the family and enjoying it. There's also kind of a tie between people wanting something and not talking about it. And I think that is probably the most interesting part of the second episode, which, because in the first episode, it becomes evident that at the end, and I don't even know if Eric himself knew this, but by the end of it, he definitely wanted a kid this whole time, right? And they make a big deal about how his girlfriend definitely doesn't want kids. You know, she was married before or something. I forget exactly what her situation
was. She's married, divorced, and is like kind of over the whole thing, and where he's kind of more of a romantic.
Yeah. And so, you know, the throughout the episode, the old aunt is making a big deal about, oh, you don't want kids, and they don't really go into the idea of that idea very much with Aaron Eckhart's character until the very end, and it becomes clear that even if it wasn't forefront in his mind, and maybe he didn't know it, that's what he was looking for. So, and then, you know, in the second episode, it's very much more clear that these people would be much, much happier if they separated, and they just don't talk about that option.
Before before we go on to the second episode or leave the first episode, I want to talk about the concept of the Romanovs in general, like this society that he is depicting. And I, you know, deliberately didn't read a whole bunch on this because is your opinion that this, like, Romanov diaspora, like, to the extent that they would, like, get together and, like, sit in conferences about their shared history, or is that a real thing? Is that something that is actually part of a pocket of the real world that maybe Weiner has researched and was interested in? Or is it just, like, almost a science fiction concept, this longing of the lost Romanov dynasty of all the Romanovs throughout the world? What do you think is more closer to the truth?
So when I saw the sign on the cruise ship for the Romanov Family Society, I made a note, and I went and I looked up the society, and apparently that society isn't real, but what is real is the association. So there's a Romanov Family Association, and I think it was formed in the 70s, and it's headquartered in, like, Sweden or something, or I don't know, some European country.
It's headquartered in Sealand.
Right, Sealand.
That's the only place the Romanovs can go to avoid their persecution.
So I guess it is kind of a real thing, but as to the extent of it, like renting out cruise ships and having these meetings on family history, I don't know.
How do you prove that, too?
Right. Is it a last name thing? It's just, well, my last name's Romanov, so.
That seems like the shittiest way to prove something ever. But yeah, I wonder, like, what the, because the whole idea is, like, a lot of these people, like, fled as refugees and outcasts. Like, how, like, you know, can you go trace your birth records back that far, back past the revolution? I don't know.
You have to own at least one Fabergé egg.
You do. Yeah. It doesn't have to be real.
Right.
It's interesting that you think that the egg was real.
No, I think it's fake.
Okay, me too. I thought, because you were like, kind of like, I thought like maybe you had some line of evidence that Fabergé egg was real.
Nah.
Okay, so yeah. So she stole a fake egg. Joke's on her.
Yep.
Fake eggs on her face. Okay, so do you want to talk about episode 2, The Royal We?
Sure.
I thought this was interesting to open. And this kind of a mundane situation, I do think that this show does excel at, like, you know, having fairly mundane situations, but do a little interesting take on them. Like in the first episode, there was like the family sitting around after dinner, drinking wine and smoking marijuana in front of their very small children, which I thought was arresting. And I'm like, well, I mean, I guess adults drink and smoke in front of children all the time. It's just weird to see them doing illegal drugs, and to the extent that you believe marijuana should or should not be, like, maybe, but like this one
is it illegal in Paris?
Man, fuck if I know. No, the Bastille they keep open explicitly to jail people that they find smoking reefer out on the streets.
Right.
Anyway, the whole starting with this marriage therapy. And I immediately did not like Corey Stoll's character because, like, I can't imagine being in a relationship with this wall of apathy.
Right.
Where it's like, well, I'll do whatever you want to do, but I'll roll my eyes and sigh when you make suggestions. And, you know, because I'm fundamentally just not, I'm an unhappy, disaffected person. But, like, you know, she's, like, this woman's doing, like, some, like, emotional work. She's trying to figure out, like, you know, they say opposites attract, but then they also say that you should have a lot of things in quality. You know, both can't be true, or maybe both can be true, and, you know.
And I like what the therapist says there. That's a movie, you know?
Yeah.
These lines were written for a purpose. Don't think that this has any analog to real life.
Right. But I thought that... I don't know, like, this is an interesting, this felt like a screwball romantic comedy with, like, you know, you've seen it, like, a bunch of different times where the guy will scheme away where there's some manufactured situation where the woman's stuck out of town or the man's stuck out of town and she's thrown in with this other person and, like, hijinks and shutsu, and it's, like, kind of a fairly lighthearted, low stakes because you don't really give a shit about Carrie Stoll. Or Corey Stoll, you don't give a shit about his wife. You don't give a shit about the relationship. So, like, seeing this guy engaged in this low stakes you know, 12 Angry Man nonsense, the win over this English Gal Gadot type, doesn't like really land. And then you're kind of happy for his wife that she's having fun on a cruise and intrigued when Noah Wiley shows up. But like, it's all kind of, you know, pretty low stakes and droll up until the very, very end where he tries to murder his wife. And that, I thought this, like, I saw this coming a mile away.
Yeah.
As soon as, like, you know, they're hiking up this thing and, you know, she's getting ahead and he's, like, giving the significant glances. But I was kind of surprised that she lived through it. Like, that was the shocking twist.
For sure.
Because I thought this was just going to be a dark, you know, like, oh, Don Draper, you know, turned his brother away and he hung himself kind of thing, you know. Or Lane Price is going to be found, committed suicide in his office. But he started off with like a screwball romantic comedy. He took it dark, and then by the end, it became a screwball romantic comedy again.
Yes, I guess I agree with that. It was very strange. I thought, I guess I was looking for the Romanoff part of it, and you know, that's weird to say in an episode where we see more Romanoffs in an episode. The most Romanoffs in an episode so far, but it felt less Romanoff-y to me than that first episode.
I don't know, like, but yeah, I thought so too. But then when we got to the cruise ship and it was Romanoff as fuck.
Yeah, but it didn't have anything to do with anything. Like that was completely incidental to the whole story, which was essentially these two people who are not in love and who do not make each other happy, trying to fake it. And, you know, going off the rails when they're not together, when they're not forced to fake it, essentially.
Interesting.
And then, you know, the darkest twist, obviously, when he tries to kill her at the end. But yeah, I guess screwball romantic comedy is pretty accurate.
Is there, so, because I thought, again, you're supposed to understand that she is almost like more Roman, well, I can't, like, I felt like there's another thing, just like when Hajar put on the costume and she became like Anastasia. Like when she showed up at that ball and was like, you know, rubbing elbows with the other Romanovs, like there was, I don't know, the idea that like she is more Romanov than the Romanovs. Like she's more effortlessly playing the part, even though she doesn't have any interest in it, or like I don't know. I felt like there was something to that.
Yeah, I think the way I read that is her thrill at seeing, you know, all of the Romanoff shit going down was kind of, to me, it said if only Corey Stoll could get his head out of his ass and appreciate what he has here and participate in his own fucking life. That maybe she would be really into this and he could be really into it and they would be happy as Romanoffs together.
Yeah, interesting. Because like that's when John Slattery shows up as this like Romanoff scholar. Like I just like it's so eye-rolly because he's talking about how like they're essentially their inheritance is that their inheritance was taken from them, and there's this internal violence and sadness that's part and parcel of the Romanoff existence, and it can't be escaped, it can't be grappled with, it's just something. And like, and they showed all the Romanoffs like kind of like thoughtfully looking, oh yeah, and you get the idea that these are all just like probably miserable son of a bitches. And then I think that the regressive and transgressive tone of their ball was supposed to suggest that like the Anushka character from the first episode, that these are kind of terrible people. Like the fact that they see themselves as this aristocratic class kind of shields them from thinking that like a medieval style passion play about the Romanovs complete with all little people is like something that can't really be done nowadays in 21st century. Like that's something you expect to see in like fucking Game of Thrones. But the whole thing is the Romanoff thing is that they're like navel gazing shits that excuse all their bad behavior because their moms and dads got murdered. Like even like Corey Stoll, when he's trying to make time with the British Gal Gadot, it's like his opening is, oh, my whole family got murdered. That doesn't touch him.
No.
Like, that's not his damage. I don't know.
No, but it's hard to tell what is his damage, honestly.
Right, right. But I don't know. It just seems like there was, like, no making these people happy. I thought there was something else instructive, like, you know, you got the people that are, like, even at her table at the ball, there was people that were, like, super into the Romanov cruise and the Romanov identity. And then they were married to people that, like, don't give a shit.
Mm.
You know, like Noah Wiley doesn't give a shit about the Romanovs and thinks it's a bunch of bullshit. The one elder fellow when the one girl was, or the one woman is like, oh, you know, if everyone's like that, the Romanov society will be dead and within a generation. He's like, oh, yeah, wouldn't that be a shame?
Right.
That's a really interesting tension to have, like, it, like, imagine, like, if you, like, I'm just trying to think of, like, imagine if I was drug on this cruise and everybody is unironically all about being a Romanov and I think this is all creepy and weird. Like, how do you have a relationship like that? And yet it seemed like that was the relationship that all the Romanovs had. Like, even the lady taking, you know, handing out the Romanov badges or like, oh, you showed up with your husband? Well, you'll have more fun with them anyway. And, you know, her husband is the guy who's, like, guest cosplaying as the Duke.
Uh-huh.
I did love him drinking and throwing the shot glasses over his shoulder, and the bartender's like, sir, you have to stop doing that. Like,
yeah.
He's just, his joy in life is destroying shot glasses.
No, it was good. Also, yeah. I can't, like, I feel bad for the little people involved in that mockery of a stage play, but I feel maybe even worse for the horse, which was carted onto this boat for a multi-day, if not week-long tour for 20 minutes of stage time.
Mm-hmm.
Not even 20 seconds of stage time.
I thought the horse was going to take a shit on the ballroom.
I did too.
Justify his existence. Also, can we talk a meta? Like, it's obviously gross if you commission a troupe of little people actors to reenact a circus, like, you know, a circus type of execution of Romanovs, right? You got your evil Rasputin. Where's the line of, like, doing that ironically in a television show as a way to say how not politically correct this crowd is?
I mean, isn't that just what actors are paid to do?
Yeah, but, like, don't you think it's got to be weird. It's like, hey, you're like if those, like, those actors, would they show up if it was unironically, hey, this is a Romanov cruise and they want you to dress like the Romanovs and they want you to run around on your little legs and play Benny Hill music behind you as your hijinks are hilarious? Would they show up for that?
Look, Nick Cage got paid I don't know how much money to do himself ironically in Mandy, so I can't feel too bad about them getting a paycheck.
I'm not ironically portray
themselves.
I'm not feeling bad. I'm just meditating on what it's like and what are the rules to this? Because, like, I agree. Like, if I could make a buck doing something, then, like, traditionally I've done that, you know, like, if I can make a buck talking about my weird cult past, I'll do that. If I can make a buck, you know, acting like a jackass on a podcast and people find it entertaining, I'll do that. Like, but there's nothing, I don't know, like, there's nothing inherently, I guess, dehumanizing about any of those things. In fact, it's like the opposite. It is like asking me to be treated as a human. And I just wonder what it's like to be like Matthew Weiner's like, hey, I want a whole bunch of little people, but it's not what you think. It's actually a parody of the thing that you think, you know, and then the agents call that. And also, like, how many, you know, how many roles are there for dwarf actors? And is Peter Dinklage taking them all? And, like, there's, like, I don't know. I just, like, I feel like there's a whole rabbit hole of questions I have that I won't get any answers to. It's just, I like that. It's like a fake Fabergé. I like to look it up, admire it, and see, you know, if it's genuine or not.
Uh-huh.
I feel like we haven't talked about Corey Stoll because he started the episode as an irredeemable shit. He was an irredeemable shit throughout the episode. And by the end of the episode, I thought briefly that he was going to learn a goddamn lesson. That, like, that this British Gal Gadot is going to teach him, like, you know, you just got a little bit of spice, made life worth, but you, the real happiness is to be found within and with your own beautiful wife who's vivacious. And, oh, by the way, fended off a very charming, very wounded Noah Wiley.
Right.
Which I've seen ER. That's a hard thing for a woman to do. Apparently.
That's a tough thing, yeah.
And, you know, she's just manifestly too good for him. And I thought he was going to realize that until he suggested the hike. And I realized that, no, in fact, he was going to try to murder this woman. And there's something.
Okay.
What? I'm sorry. What was your OO on that?
Well, I was just thinking, so you must have read the breakdown in the therapist's office very differently from the way I did, because I read that entire, like, oh, I finally realized what's important thing as not him realizing his wife is important, but realizing that he's not happy with his wife because he doesn't have the freedom to experience that feeling that he got running around on his wife, essentially.
Right.
And so I kind of knew from there on. And when the night before they went on the hike, when he suggests, hey, we should go on a hike tomorrow, I was like, oh, no, this is bad. This is very bad.
Yeah, because I guess I should. No, so I thought that the therapist office breakdown, I was with you.
Oh,
but
okay.
Then when she, like, embraced him and he kind of, like, melted into her embrace, I thought, like, well.
But I didn't see that. What I saw is a man who was having a breakdown, a woman who had arms around him, but he was not giving an inch there.
Hmm, interesting. I guess, because I was with you, I thought that the breakdown was over him realizing he wasn't in love with his wife, but then.
Yeah.
I thought in the ensuing days, like, maybe that he's, you know, like, because, like, there's, I just felt like there had to be redemption for his character.
You would think so, yeah.
Or this poor woman is stuck with this guy for the rest of her life. I guess the redemption is for her. She gets to, like, I mean, I don't even know what it's like to realize that your husband that I think, she, you know, you genuinely care for is not only didn't love you, but also was going to, like, murder you instead of, like, doing the right thing, which is breaking up with you.
I mean, such a fucking cowardly way out, right?
It is, man. But, like, you hear about this shit all the time. Like, these guys that feel trapped in relationships, but their pride is like, well, I can't get a divorce because then I'd look like a bad dude. I know I'll murder my wife and get away with it. Like,
right.
This shit happens not regularly, but, like, you know, the fact that it's happened non-zero numbers of times is a shocking indictment of the moral craptitude of the human soul. But the fact that he did this after every evidence to the this British Gal Gadot has said, no, it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. Not even if you were single. Like, I'm not even tempted. I love my husband. One of the reasons I love my husband is he's dumb enough that I can step out and he's none the wiser, and I'm a beautiful, urbane, desirable woman, and I can get away with it. And you are like Corey Stoll, who is weirdly magnetic and attractive to people, even though it defies kind of like common sense and conventional wisdom. But you're in the Adam Driver zone of a goofy looking dude that women find irresistible. So go, and your wife is an idiot. So go out and have fun. And he just fucking. Just heard, like, oh no, sailor, if you murder your wife, I'll be available. Mm-hmm. It's some cringy it was some cringy ass shit that I was watching.
It is, yeah.
Like, just like that, the montage of him calling her and calling her and not getting return calls, just crazy town. So
yeah, and you talk about you know, Corey Stoll, the ER guy, whatever, Noah Wiley.
Noah Wiley, yeah.
Their magnetism. Ever since I've seen Halt and Catch Fire, which is where I was introduced to Carrie Bichet, I really, really like her. First of all, she's beautiful. I mean, that helps. But she's able to, like, convey, like, a bizarre, like, pure innocence and also, like, mischievous bad girl. Like, there's a massive gulf between those two things, and yet she walks both sides of that gulf.
Yeah.
Effortlessly. And, you know, she always seems like she's very sharp, too. She's, at least the character she's playing, I mean, the actress is able to bring that to the role, so.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I'm, like, a huge fan of Carrie Bichet now.
I am, too, and I remember her being Scoot McNairy's wife, right?
Yes.
Because I saw the first, I think, two seasons of that. I thought that, yeah, like, I guess I would say that she's appealing. Like, in like, kind of like a Carrie Coons kind of way. Like, a multidimensional, yes, they're attractive, but they're also, like you said, they seem very bright. They seem kind of like game and up for anything, and like they seem like they'd be a lot of fun to be with, but also interesting. Like, yeah, I totally, and I guess that's one of the frustrations is you see, you know, this guy who's built his whole life, because you also find out that like they work together, and I think that she maybe is the one that owns the company, and he just works there.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, this is sounding more like Halt and Catch Fire every day.
Right. Like that, like he's built his whole life around, and it's a good life, but he is bored for whatever reason because he thinks he should. I thought it's interesting that when she was on board the cruise, she saw an old painting of a Romanov that looked exactly like him.
Uh huh.
So like, I think it's interesting that like when I heard like the pitch about this being 21st century Romanovs, like there was a little bit of tongue in cheek implying that they're not really Romanovs, they're like diluted Romanovs. But I felt like every one of these episodes so far gives pretty compelling reason to believe that the person is an actual Romanov, whatever the fuck that means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if I found out I would, it's weird because like if I found out I was a Romanov right now, I don't think it would change one bit how I feel about myself. Like, yeah. But Corey,
you
like,
have to get a Fabergé egg, though.
I get. I mean,
hard to come by.
That's what happened. I think they ride up to your house in a chain, and they ride up with in a big coach,
a carriage,
and they give you the Fabergé egg, and inside it says, "Congratulations, you're a Romanov."
Right.
But like it's not a call to adventure. It's not a like, oh, well, now I know all the things that are broken inside of me. And like, it's like, it'd be like the same way if I found out I was, I don't know. I can't think of anything like that. Like it's almost treated like it's a, you know, Daisy Ridley finding out that she's a Jedi.
Okay. Yeah.
Like it's this thing that like this knowledge that alters your entire life course and how you perceive your life and contentment. And it's almost like a disease where you could be surrounded by beauty and opulence and culture and still feel like you have lost something. Because it's not the fucking empire that your family built and it was taken away from you.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely getting what they're putting down there. And it's interesting when I look at the Corey Stoll character, I think he's a bit of an enigma, but also I think I can see something within the Romanov stuff that makes him the way he is, because they do make it a point to say that he is essentially the employee within this company, right? Mm-hmm, and that that Carrie Bichet is the one who's calling the shots. And then, you know, him acting out is very much like an expression of or reclaiming of his freedom in some twisted, fucked up way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if he were the aristocracy of the early 1900s, he would be able to do whatever the fuck he wants, right? And you look at the stuff that happens on the boat with the Romanovs, they're doing whatever the fuck they want. And it's not good. They're doing very bad things in some cases. But I think that's one of the things that I don't know if Corey Stoll's character understands that in the episode, but the episode is trying to kind of say that, is that this is a man who 100 years ago would have been a king, would have been able to do absolutely anything he wants. And now he's like, I don't want to do anything because I can't do everything that I want.
Yeah, it kind of dovetails into like what Slattery was saying about the Romanovs and like what an impressive regime they were, because like he mentioned as laudable, and there's all these Romanovs nodding. It's like they maintained feudalism until well into the 20th century, and I'm like, right. The fuck, man! You know, it's like saying America's burned coal well into the 21st century. It's like it might be true, but it's not something that we should laud or brag about. Or yeah. Like, I rode a horse today, every day until the Starship Enterprise came. It's like, who gives a shit? Like, that's you. So yes, this family is stayed in the way of progress, and were brutally massacred because the people apparently were so happy with the way things ran that they were popularly revolted against and killed. I don't know. There's a little – I thought there was some kind of interesting stuff that I think it's – because, like, you know, one of the one of the criticisms about, like, you know, Me Too and the crazy idea of respecting women and consent in general is like, oh, it'll be the death of passion and romance in a world. Mm-hmm. And I felt like this scene at the lake house was kind of like a response to that, how, like, you know, they were playing with little non-consensual consent, but the woman, like, at one point, the British Gal Gadot type, like, had to tell Corey Stoll to stop and have him actually, like, respect the fact that he would stop. Mm-hmm. And then she flipped the sexual dynamic. And I thought that all stuff was very, very sexy, but mm-hmm. it was also all done within the rubric of like, consent and respect. And that's a pretty good way of saying that, like, yeah, you know, making sure that people actually want to have sex with you before you have sex with them, not necessarily the death of sexuality and romance. Uh-huh. That some would say it is. Hey, everybody, before we get into the feedback for the Romanovs, I want to talk about Club Bald Move, club.baldmove.com. And the reality is, if you enjoyed our discussion of the Romanovs and looking forward to hearing us talk about it in the upcoming weeks, there's zero chance we'd be doing that without the club. If the club didn't exist, the funds for us to do podcasts on a full-time basis. And if you heard our housekeeping, you know that we're going to have like 6 different podcasts dropping this week alone. We just wouldn't be able to do it. And it's not an altruistic thing like, oh my God, I want to hear him talk about the Romanovs, I better pay. You also get a bunch of bonus features for your money. You get access to ad-free feeds, video versions of a lot of our podcasts, bonus content such as Quips and Lunch with Jim and Aaron, some of the content of the upcoming Super Serious Film Fest are going to be exclusive to club members. You don't want to miss out on that. Check out club.baldmove.com for more information and sign up today. We have some feedback that I'm going to consider now. Benny up front says, I'm sure the series will give you all the historic information that you need to know, but if it whets your appetite, Robert Massey's book, Nicholas and Alexandria, the classic account of the fall of the Romanov dynasty, is a fascinating read. The last family of czars was brought down by a string of really unfortunate and preventable mistakes, with a strong supporting role from the mystic slash con artist Rasputin. You can draw a straight line from the events of the world of the book through the rise of communism, the Cold War, and much of the conflict found in the world today. It reads as much like a novel as it does like history, and you may be interested even to show isn't your cup of tea. They mentioned they're not the author related or being endorsed. They just like the book. I wonder, because like some of the stuff Benny's saying here makes me think that this book might be a little too romanticized. Because... yeah, like I don't know, like, because I've heard a lot of different things about like how big a role Rasputin had in the family, you know, what how the Romanovs are seen as by their people, and but you know, like I keep coming back to, like, they maintained a feudal regime into the 20th century. Yeah. That sentence is not a glowing endorsement of their rule, but. Yeah, I just want to shout that out in case, or if there is a Romanov historian that's got a better, like, if you had to choose one book to read about the Romanovs, because the reality is, I'm going to have to choose one book. I'm not going to read multiple books on the Romanovs. I might not even read the one if I get through the first, like, 30 pages and think it's stupid. So, but I want to throw that out there.
I won't be reading the one.
Not even one.
And then, no, like I said at the beginning, this is not a topic that I'm at all interested in. Inherently. Didn't Dan Carlin do an episode of Hardcore History on the Russian aristocracy?
You know, I think he touched on it as a meditation. Of how much death touched these families, like, that, you know, because the czar loved his wife, like, you know, like, seemed like everyone agrees he loved his wife, and yet there's so many of their children died, and how much, like, mm-hmm. sadness that would, like, bring into a house, in a way that, like, we in the 21st century can't really relate to, like, having 13 children and 11 of them die. Mm-hmm. Those are made up facts and figures, but, like, it's similar to that. So I don't think he did a whole episode on it, but I think he did touch on that maybe in the context of the countdown to Armageddon. I don't know, but yeah, I remember a little bit about the Romanovs coming out of Dan Carlin's authoritative mouth. Moving on to Majam says, I wonder if the whole Romanov theme cruise was copied from an actual cruise itinerary. I know obviously theme cruises exist, but this one seems so odd and decadent. I'm not sure it would be my cup of tea, but it's fun to see an episode and how the Shelley character reacted to all the events as they rolled out. Kind of wish you'd followed up on the picture of the Romanoff that looked just like Corey Stoll in the Slattery lecture. Like I said, I deliberately, yeah, Jim's looked it up, but I'm like, halfway through this episode, I thought about how much research I wanted to do. And I'm like, you know what? I just want to pretend like this is all real. Okay. I want to uncritically take this Romanoff concept as a fictional concept. Because it's not like I knew enough that Matthew Weiner wasn't crowing about all the research he did into the Romanov history and how historically accurate it was. But I do think you've got some hope here, Majam, that they will make something of that. Because, again, I know that John Slattery's character comes back for a larger role in a later episode. So it stands to reason there will be other threads that maybe connect all these together. Jamie T., I was watching the first episode and I loved it. I thought that Eric calling the woman Hagar accidentally by mistake and being raised on Bible stories myself made me pay very close attention to that. Do you remember from our shared mythology, no, Jim, the character of Hagar?
I remember the name. I don't remember the story.
So Hagar was the servant girl or slave girl of Sarah, the wife of Abraham. And, you know, Abraham and Sarah old as shit, like in their 90s, right. And God told them to make children. And she decided to, since they were having trouble, let Abraham use her servant or slave girl. They had a son called Ishmael that then they got driven out of the family after Isaac came along. But it was kind of, I think Jamie's onto something here about... I mean, I don't think there's like a truly deeper meaning. This is another one of like the circles of hell concept that Matthew Weiner broadly chose to paint an emotional palette with. But like, you know, there wasn't a literal, you know, circles of hell and Mad Men that Don Draper was stuck in, even though people spilt a lot of ink trying to make that happen. I think it's more of like the concept of a substitute coming along to fulfill, like, you know, this dynasty, this idea of having to have an heir. So like if you had like, you know, if you're like Jamie or me and you heard that, do you perk up and you pay a little bit more attention? But I don't think it has anything deeper than that, though. People want to develop that theory. Send it in to TV@baldmove.com. Final email. Dimmick says, while watching the first episode, I had an uneasy feeling that the characters were all pretty ridiculous, but that would make total sense since everything had to be a little bit louder for the story to make an impact. Once I settled in within the world Weiner had built, actually every character felt so natural. That's something that I kind of felt too, that like I was trying to get at, like, how would you express the depths of Don Draper in 30 minutes? If you had to explain him, his relationship to Betty, his relationship with Peggy, the rivalry with Pete, his friendship with Roger, like how would you get that in 30 minutes? And that's what Matthew Weiner has to do in every single episode. He has to sketch these characters. You have to know what they're about. You have to know what they want, and you have to know how they'll interplay with each other. Or the thing doesn't work. Of course, a lot of people are saying it's not exactly working. So, but I still think it's pretty amazing what he's able to do in just like 30, 40 minutes. I do have a minor quibble, which is that I think the Weiner has a type when it comes to his female leads. Sophie in episode 1 and Michelle in episode 2 can both be body doubles for Jessica Paris. And how can anyone not see Megan dancing with the Charles Manson lookalike in season 7, episode 5, The Runaways, when Michelle was slinking next to the jukebox? Not to mention, Shelley is basically an even thinner version of Betty Draper.
I mean, one of them is kind of a French girl.
One of them
lives in Paris at least for 5 years.
Like, I didn't see that they were all... I guess they all look alike and that they're all slim, attractive Hollywood women.
Right. I was going to say Hollywood has a type too.
I did like sit up a little bit and took notice of Sophie being extremely tall because I noticed she was wearing flat sandals and she was as tall as Aaron Eckhart, which I remember reading him as being at least 6'1", maybe 6'2". So I'm like, damn, that is a tall, tall woman. But yeah, other than that, I didn't recognize them as all being kind of the same other than, like you said, they're leading ladies in Hollywood. So they're all kind of a type.
I don't think Gary Bechet has much in common, even visually, with January Jones.
Mm. I mean, I guess maybe skin tone, but yeah, other than that, because like Janet Jones is very much an ice queen of dubious acting and emoting abilities. And I wouldn't say that about, what'd you say your last name is?
Bichet? Yeah.
Finally, Michael Romanoff is a Pete Campbell type. His entitlement, the weasel-like tactic to get laid, the obsession over a casual fling, the inability to scheme, the hair loss. I love them all.
Yeah, he's not wrong.
Other than I think Corey Stoll has got that little bit Jeff Goldblum, you know, Adam Driver energy where he's like punching way above his weight. And I'd never say that about Pete Campbell.
okay.
Yeah, you're right. He's got this like little mini Pete. Like, I don't know that Pete would have killed somebody, but he definitely raped a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, Michael at his worst is an attempted murderer.
That's true.
So, I don't know. It is interesting how, as you said, both of these episodes ended on women breaking away from the Romanoff clan and having big smiles on their faces. Do you think that'll be something that Winer continues with, or is this going to be just a weird artifact of the first two episodes?
I don't know. I guess we'll see in future weeks.
I guess we shall see. That's all for feedback. That's all for our discussion of the Romanovs. We'll be back next week, next Monday, with the discussion of this third episode. If you have some feedback you'd like to send in, do so at tv@baldmove.com. Or you can also participate in our threads on our forum, forums.baldmove.com, about the Romanovs. That's all we got for this week. Again, we'll see you next time. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.